Hello. We're live from New York City. Check 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2. My headphones are low. All right. Happy St. Patrick's Day, everybody. New York City is a buzz. Matter of fact, the parade just started. Open the window here. We're doing a jig. All right. Well, I'm not really doing a jig because I'm a kind of a not really coordinated Irishman, you know, 6'3", lanky. But I get a few pints in me, then I can do the jig. But you know what's really cool is I was walking down the street, and of course, you know, construction workers are known for certain things, but this is really cool. Walking down the street, and these guys are on a flatbed with their hard hats on, their reflective vest, and they start doing a jig, and they start screaming, Happy St. Patrick's Day! Happy St. Patrick's Day, everybody! That's a New York City moment. I love that. What a great feeling. Hey, this is Insight on PRN, the Progressive Radio Network. My name is Mark Farrell. Happy St. Patrick's Day, wherever you are. This is the, I don't know what, how many parade this is. We'll say 58th. It's got to be a lot. And New York City is perfect weather. Happy to say it's going to be 60s today. Clear skies and great, great turnout today. I love New York City on days like this. It's such a buzz. Keep that music going, my friend. We're still talking Irish here. Got a great show ahead of us. You are going to hear some trailblazers today. Joanne Dean and Michelle Spitz are two people who come from a similar background and are brought together on a more common background, making movies accessible for everyone. And we're going to talk about that very, very great goal that they're reaching and have done incredible, stellar work for many, many years on. As a matter of fact, we reunited, Joanne and I, this past week at the Real Abilities Film Festival, which you've heard about on the show here, that I had the Isaac Zablocki, the executive director, on 2 weeks ago, and one of the producers for a movie, Do You Dream in Color, which I saw last week, which was phenomenal. I had a great opportunity to host a panel discussion, moderate that, and that was a blast with Abby and her producer, Regina. I just forgot Regina's last name. But anyway, it was very good. As a matter of fact, it ended last night. It was a great success, and we can talk about that and a few more great pivotal things, timely things in just a few minutes. But also, I want to talk to you about the NFL. The NFL has made a pivotal decision. Finally, they finally got their heads out of their helmets. I mean, you know where they came out of. After years, the NFL is disputing evidence that connected football to chronic traumatic, damaging, degenerative brain diseases found in nearly 100 former players. A top official in the league for the first time acknowledged the link, the echo. It's almost like the echo of Big Tobacco's decision. Remember that, ladies? Back in, what was that, like the late 90s, that smoking causes cancer. Well, no kidding. So this is huge for the NFL to make this statement. So the, it makes clear that they are now finally accepting what, you know, science has already known for years, that there is a direct link that exists between traumatic brain injury and CTE. You know, this has been something that they've invested millions and millions and millions of dollars in for the last several years. But it's interesting because they've always tamped down the actual results, like the new movie, Will Smith. That's a whole other story because he didn't get, didn't get an Oscar award, didn't get nominated. But anyway, the plot of the movie is about how the evidence has been evident for a while. As a matter of fact, the NFL has directed millions of dollars to research CTE and gave $45 million. I didn't know this. $45 million to USA Football. Who is USA Football? Exactly. Formerly an obscure nonprofit to promote self-tackling reassurance. Jittery parents, of course, because, of course, if you have jittery parents, they're not going to allow their kids to play football, and obviously will impact the future players on the gridiron. So the league has hired experts to monitor the games, blah, blah, blah. So, you know, think about this. I think this is a really smart move because if you admit something, if you say X is linked to Y, so, and you decide to play football, well, you're signing on a dotted line. You are giving up any culpability because you know going into the sport that it's dangerous. So the NFL admission is, you know, it kind of makes a world of sense for them because no matter how many millions of dollars they pay right now, they're saying basically from this point on, and whatever that point will be, maybe it's 2016 or not, and I'm sure that'll be determined in court. For future sufferers, the NFL will basically not be liable. They won't be culpable. So if you want to play professional football, like my future guest here, we'll meet in a few minutes. I know that's on their resume, the bucket list, like to play football. It comes with risks that are, you know, inherent with the sport, and ultimately could result in brain diseases. So, it's not a laughing matter. Certainly there's a lot of people who, play this for many, many reasons. Number one, because that's all they know. They have that football bubble they've been living in all their life, ever since they were very, very successful and popular in high school, right through college. Maybe they only spent 2 years in college and catapulted and drafted right into the NFL. But the reality is, you know, they may know that the continuing playing of professional football, being, you know, pounded in the head countless times in a practice, you know, 6 days a week, 5 days a week, and then the game where, you know, no holds are barred, you know, can do ultimate injury. But again, they don't know any better. This is who they are. This is what they've been told they are good at in life, the only thing that they're good at. And a few weeks ago, I recall mentioning to you that the Ivy League football teams, well, exactly, who are they? I called it brains over brawn. Well, they decided recently, ladies, I'm not sure if you noticed, that they are not going to have tackle practices in the regular season, which is huge, I believe. Because, again, these aren't the Big Ten teams, but we have to start somewhere. It set the precedent that, okay, let's find out what kind of result this will have on a season. Because will there be less injuries? I'm sure there'll be less injuries immediately and maybe 5-10 years down the road, and CTE-wise, brain damage injuries. But secondly, will there be a lack of excellence and or performance? Will the games be lower scoring? And it'd be interesting to see when the Ivies play each other versus the other teams that, you know, are not taking tackling out of the practices. So there's a wealth of information to be discovered, but I think it's a great step in a very positive and healthy direction, which I'm very happy to see. And to a certain degree, I applaud the NFL. I think they're doing it for, I don't want to be a naysayer. I like to say they're doing it for the right reason, but I think they're doing it for their own self-interest. Because obviously there has been a boatload of lawyers who've been going over papers, history, precedents, or thinking about what precedent this will set if they don't admit this and keep the denial factor going. But I think as a lawyer wannabe, that this makes a lot of sense. Because if you say there is danger, like when you jump out of a plane, right, which I did stupidly. I survived, actually, because I'm talking to you right now. But the amount of paperwork I had to sign, because, you know, it's parachutes are faulty items. They can be faulty, as we've all heard about that. But basically, you are taking an inherent risk. So very same thing with any kind of hockey, soccer. You know, obviously, the risks are minimal compared to football, especially professional football, where we're playing with Adonises. You know, 300 pounds is kind of the norm. 350, not uncommon. So this is certainly headed in the right direction. Roger Goodell, a man who I'm not sure is really behind this. There's a safety officer. Obviously, he's going to support it. But I think there's obviously, I'm sure the owners were in meetings with the lawyers, ultimately decide that this is going to be yay or nay. But this is something that's going to set a precedent, and I wish everybody moving forward, who plays in the NFL, to hopefully maybe the union will be behind this and be able to make some safer rules. Now, as a parent, does this impact your decision to let your child or children play? I think so. Because the reality is, you know, anytime you get a blow to the head, my son last year at 5 years old played soccer. He bumped into another player. Just like a pinball, boop, and just bounced off each other. Kept playing the rest of the soccer practice. I had him in the car on the ride home. He said, "Dad, I'm really thirsty." I'm like, "Oh, that's, you know, it was a little hot out. Let's get some water in you." I started hydrating. Half an hour later, he's vomiting profusely. I knew exactly what it was. I had a concussion once, very, very bad concussion once. Took him to the hospital, and it was scary because for about 3 or 4 hours, he was not himself at all. Couldn't have focus with his eyes. Complete lethargy, many, many different factors. My wife and I were freaking out. So, and that's just soccer. I mean, that can, obviously, there's no head protection involved. Actually, I think it's being lobbied. But the reality is, you know, playing football, I mean, my son's never going to play football. He can when he gets out of the house and goes to college, but when he's living under our roof, there's no way. And I don't tell him there's no way. I just give him the information that's available right now. And he's made, you know, the decision at 6 years old that I don't want to play Pop Warner. I said, you know, he goes like, Dad, I want to play football. I said, okay, well, let me just tell you, you know, about football. It's a fun sport. We watch it on TV. And sometimes I don't like to watch it on TV as much as I used to, because I have a lot of disdain, maybe I didn't use the word disdain, for the sport now, because I think it's very hypocritical because of the owners and the coaches who are injecting all these athletes with whatever you name it, kind of drugs to keep them so-called healthy to perform. Obviously, the CTE brain injuries that are being reported for years now, and so on and so on. And more importantly, the off-field antics from all these professional players. Where are their ethics? Where are their morals? Okay, there's a lot of them out there that do possess these, and I think they are should be held to a higher status and accountability because so many people are looking up to them. Oh, and P.S., they're making $5, $10, $20, $30, $50 million per year or over 2-3 years. What is it? Fitzhenry, the quarterback for the Jets, is being offered $10 million for the 2016 season, but he wants $15 million, and he's a so-so quarterback. I mean, come on. That's the reality of it. So now, as a parent, what are you going to do? Will your child play football? That's your decision. I definitely strongly suggest making setting aside a lot of time to research it. Talk to other parents. Maybe you have friends with older children. Talk to them. See how they liked it, what they didn't like. Yes, gear is getting more protective and more safe, but the reality is they're still out in the field playing contact sport, and that's a big issue. So always love to hear your feedback as well. 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. So I've talked to you before about my experience, the so much fun experience with anxiety and panic attacks and depression. God, I love talking about this stuff. No, I do. But going through it when I initially did, after a few years after my brother died, you know, it was really, really debilitating. I was so scared. I was scared blankless, thinking that, oh, my God, my life is going to be over, et cetera, et cetera. But those are just the terrible, fleeting thoughts that go through your mind. And science doesn't understand that. And they understand what happens when you have panic attacks and anxiety usually develops into depression. They don't know why, just the chemistry ends that way or elevates that way. But I want to read you something that I before I lead into that, I want to tell you that it was something that I can't say I was embarrassed about, but I felt it should be a very private family matter. And some of my closest friends didn't know about it because I was still going through the thick of it. And in hindsight, I should have reached out to more of my friends and say, listen, here's the reality of what I'm experiencing. And, you know, I'll be fine. But, you know, I'm just going through a little bit of a difficult lull time right now. But I didn't. And I understand why. And I've suffered a little bit since then, but mildly, and I'm much more vocal about it. Obviously, I'm on a microphone. I speak in front of audiences, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 people, et cetera, for the last couple of years, talking about my mental illness issues and how I got over it. And even on my worst days, I knew I was going to get better. I don't know that whether that's the genetic wiring. There's a lot of research done on that versus the person who feels like they are not going to pull through. But that's one of the things I always urge people to, is that you have to. One of the hardest things is, but most important, is that you have to put your hand up and say, listen, I need help. This is what's going on. So on the heels of that, I want to read you something because I think this is very interesting because of a lot of what mental health and mental illness as perceived as people who are weak and people who, I hate to say, belong in a leper colony. But, you know, that's how some people feel. We've made gained great ground in the last 10 years, especially with a lot of people coming out publicly speaking. But then I thought about last night when I turned on Robin Williams' last movie. What a shame. I mean, this guy, I mean, he publicly said that he had suffered from depression, and I wasn't sure. Was it bipolarness as well? I think bipolarness as well. And, I mean, a person with all that, I'm sure, great medical assistance at his disposal just goes to show you it's a very, very powerful issue. Anyway, so I wanted to read to you a portion of an article I read the other day, and it's titled Why I'm Not Ashamed of Identifying as Mentally Ill, and it's by Olivia James, and I'll give her name at the end as well, because I think you'll find and again, when I read this to you, I don't need and I don't want people to go out and say they should, you know, have a shirt that's labeled, "Hi, I'm, you know, proud to be mentally ill," or anything like that, wave a flag or things of that nature. But, you know, it may give food for thought about just feeling a little bit better about yourself, because it's not like you asked for a broken leg, you asked to get cancer, you asked to get mental illness. No, it's just something that happens. You know, we're born with what we have, red hair, you're short, you're tall, you're, you know, prone to being overweight, you're very, very thin, whatever, blue eyes, whatever the case may be. This is just the reality of who we are. So mental illness is not exclusively negative. Yeah, depression and anxiety have screwed me over more than once, but my anxiety makes me truly a badass worker. I love that line. My depression makes me compassionate, and my borderline personality disorder makes me empathetic. Taking away those elements of my personality doesn't just take away things that hurt me, but also irreparably changes me and the awesome person I am. This is a basic tenet of neurodiversity. I don't know if that's a word, but I love it. I don't know if she coined that, but a neurodiversity, I love that. And I strongly stand by the fact that my brain wasn't the weird place it is. I would not be depressed, but I also wouldn't be as badass as I am. Goes on to say, so yes, I will continue putting mentally ill at the top of my list of self-identifiers, along with the nerd, writer, and social justice warrior, because these are the things I pay attention to each and every day. It is healthy and important for me to include my mental illness on that list. If I don't pay attention to it, then there's, like everything else, likelihood that I will end up in a nasty, depressed place that's truly dangerous. But more than that, I'm not ashamed of it. I'm not going to pretend it isn't incredibly important because it's supposed to be negative or involve stigma. That is letting the mental illness win. So that is written by Olivia James. And if you're familiar with The Mighty, I've talked about this before on my show, themighty.com, M-I-G-H-T-Y.com. It is a website that's devoted to mental illness, all sorts of disabilities across the board, you name it. And it's also a great brainchild of people in the creative world who are also very prone to, just like everybody else on this planet, mental illness or any sort of other disability, hearing impairment, visual impairment, blindness, double amputee, you name it. But that's a great website, themighty.com. As a matter of fact, if you have a very interesting or compelling story, they're always looking for contributors. I don't know if there's any compensation for it, but the reward of putting your personal story out there and the feedback is worth any compensation in my book that you could possibly receive. So we are here on a Thursday. Where's that jig music? Come on, I got my, I am a little bit kiltless today, but I feel like jigging. Are we jigging? We're not jigging. We're not jigging because my producer, Jesse, has been hitting the bottle. He's been hitting the bottle since 6 a.m. Hitting the bottle there, Jesse, huh? Come on, my lad. There we go, my lad. Here we go. Here we go. All right, so we're live in New York City on St. Patrick's Day. I cannot do an Irish brogue to save my life. I can do an Indian accent, but I had to switch gears. Hold on a second. Hello. No, I can't do it. I can't switch gears like that. All right, so we're moving on here. It's a beautiful day in New York City, and we're switching gears from mental illness, from the NFL. We just cover it all here, don't we? Yes, we love it. That's what's the fun thing about Progressive Radio Network. We're free form here. We can do what we like, as we like, for as long as we like. Well, many, many years ago, I had the pleasure of meeting our first guest, Joanne Dean. I forget when exactly or how, but we were both involved with a great world that Joanne has stayed in exclusively. I have had my toe in, sometimes my full leg, but have been in and out of it for the most part. Joanne Dean is an independent producer for live panels across the country. And she and also involved with Sundance Film Festival for 15 years or so. Is that true, Diane? Joanne? and her goal in life is to basically make all films accessible. And it started all years and years ago, working with the deaf and hearing impaired community. Welcome to the show.
Hi. It's
so
great
to be reconnected.
Yes, it is.
So Joanne came up to me the other day at the Real Abilities Film Festival after I was moderating a panel. She came up to me. She goes, Mark, how are you? Remember me? And I'm looking at her going like, you could see my eyes register.
Yes,
but I'm
I
looking
know.
For the name on my Pentium and searching. She's like, Joanne, I'm like, oh, it's so great to see you. So great to reconnect. I'm so glad your stay in New York City was long enough so I can have you on the show.
Definitely. I'm very happy to be here. And great to see you again. And we were connected. It was through WeMedia.
Oh, yes, I know that part. But in terms of the actual event, WeMedia, very quickly, I've mentioned this before, was the first website and magazine for people with disabilities or friends and family. And it was great. It was short-lived. Unfortunately, they spent a boatload of money, way too much more money than they should have. But it was part of the dot-com bubble bursting thing, but it was a great way, and it was actually a great model for other companies to come
Yes,
to learn
was.
Not to spend money, how to not spend money, and also what kind of formula kind of works, which is nice. So talk to me about how you initially got into this field, because you are not deaf or hearing impaired.
At the time, no, I was not deaf, but oddly enough, I did go into deaf education. I was at CSUN in California, moved, transplanted from New York, right after seeing, this is very, maybe my reason for going west. I happened to attend after college the play on Broadway, Children of a Lesser God, and that play starred Phyllis Frelick, who inspired me in the audience. I had worked with deaf and hard of hearing students, so I was going into education. I was going for my master's in deaf education, and I happened to go to Broadway, and I love theater. I'm a New Yorker, and there's Phyllis Frelick on stage, and she's signing, and Tony Roberts is the actor.
Wow.
And I'm saying, I want to meet her, and I want to work with her, and I want to do what he's doing, interpreting. And so I met Phyllis, and oddly enough, I was moving to California. She was going west to set up Deaf West Theater in Los Angeles. And so she said, when you get there, come and meet me. And so that was really the beginning. So I was able to volunteer for Deaf West Theater. And at the same time, deaf actors were organizing at Cal State Northridge, where I was also going to school at the time.
And what year is this, Joanne?
Oh, we don't say.
Okay.
Well, it was back.
A good 15, 20 years ago.
It was
ago.
About 15, 20 okay, years good. Ago. So at that time,
nothing in place, certainly back then.
No. I don't have anybody in my family that's deaf, hard of hearing. I was involved in Special Olympics. I volunteered at Lexington School for the Deaf.
And a lover of the arts.
A lover of the arts. And I love sign language. I saw sign language. It's visual.
Hmm.
It's visual cinema in my world.
No, I can see that. Sure.
Yeah. And so I happened to be in the right place. And so in learning sign language, when I was going to classes, they said, what do you love? And I said, theater. And it happened to be that all the deaf actors were organizing, those that were in SAG-AFTRA, the Actors Union.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Now SAG-AFTRA. At that time, it was SAG. Phyllis Frelick happened to be a SAG member, and then started to chair Performers with Disabilities. And the deaf and hard of hearing really started to feel like they needed their own organization. So they were organizing, and I kept showing up at the deaf plays at the college, and they kept saying, who are you? And I could barely sign, but they needed somebody hearing to they were having these meetings, and they wanted to take notes. So I was going for English and studying, you know, English was my major also. So I got invited to come, and they said, you could be our secretary.
Slash interpreter.
Well, at that time I was still a baby interpreter.
Okay.
So I was still learning.
Budding interpreter.
Yes, a budding interpreter, exactly. But I had a wealth of deaf entertainers, and they are the people that really are the movers and shakers now, 25 years later. And Deaf West is established, as you know, New York, Spring Awakening, revival that just hit Broadway. That brought me here back to New York and back to the theater. And Deaf West Theater, 25 years later, is having its second run on Broadway. And
fantastic.
Yeah, so that's kind of my New York story.
So tell me about the genesis of the show that you started.
So at the same time, when I was involved with the deaf community, I was also, fast forward, I was teaching then. Now I'm teaching in a school, deaf education, and...
What level?
Primary, so it was pre-K through fifth at that time in Los Angeles. And I was amazed coming out of college after just meeting a wealth of ASL, American Sign Language users, talent, incredible educators, going into the school system now as a certified educator to find a mess. I was teaching in Compton, East Los Angeles.
Wow.
Very ethnically diverse, low income. It was a challenge. And so I was constantly calling CSUN back, and at CSUN were all these deaf actors. So I started to do a deaf awareness program. And at the school, so now you were talking, now you have a son. Now picture your son going into preschool, and you'd like to see a natural progression of how kids, what they're going to learn. Well, these deaf children going from pre-K to fifth grade, they were so smart, because the first level, there was one deaf teacher who signed. Now another teacher who had the second grade was doing signing exact English. So picture breaking up a word, I under, like, and making a sign as if you're going, your hand's going under another hand, understand, which has no logical conceptual base whatsoever. So these kids are learning. They go from ASL at this time to a signing exact English teacher for the second grade. For the third grade, the teacher used only finger spelling. And then for the fourth grade, another class, the teacher refused to sign.
You're going to be doomed.
And then the fifth grade, the deaf teacher's there. So now a deaf teacher's
takes
got him
over,
back.
Sure.
And so this poor, I mean, and I'm saying poor, I mean, frustrated with the system. Eventually, you know, that this is not still the case, but it's, I'm speaking of this because there is an issue currently within schools for the deaf nationally. Districts are trying to close the state schools for the deaf, and
all funding?
Funding base, but even as far as to be able to run the school, it's not run by people of the same language, American Sign Language. So it's taking somebody of another language saying, okay, I'm going to run your school, but I speak a different language. It doesn't work.
So okay.
It does work if you work together. I want to rephrase that.
Very naive question here. If someone speaks Spanish, is the interpretation different?
Yes. Sign language is not international.
It's not universal. Wow.
Each country has its own sign language because it's bound to
of
culture.
Course.
And so there is an international language that's a system, sign language, but that's agreed upon between the countries and all the World Federation for the Deaf.
I never pondered that before. So the Italians must be all over the place.
They're all over the place.
That's for sure.
Oh, you're from Italy.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So tell me about how it started here. If you want to make a program.
So now I'm teaching. Now I've got my foot still in CSUN, and I'm also with the deaf actors. So I started creating a deaf awareness program within the school system, and I carried that with me. And with that, I brought in deaf actors to teach drama. So I always had deaf actors by my side. In fact, when I switched from that school, and ultimately that school program was closed, and the county education took over, when I went to my next school, my deaf actor, who is a playwright, actor, he ended up getting hired with me at a school for the deaf. I said, I'm hearing. I said, if you want to hire me, hire somebody who's deaf. And I said, he helped me through school. And so my principal ended up at the new school, ended up hiring Bob Hilterman, fabulous actor. He was in the stage play of Children of a Lesser God, oddly enough. And So from that, creating the deaf awareness and seeing all that, I just saw a lack in Hollywood. And at that time, it was pre-captioning. There was no captioning on TV. Marlee Matlin was advocating for captioning. Local
so captioning, just so our listeners are aware,
this
that
is 25 years ago.
That is the words at the bottom of the screen.
Yes. So captioning at that time was really something foreign. Today, everybody benefits by captioning, airports, banks. But 25 years
ago,
bars, exactly, St. Patty's Day. You know where you're going on the train.
Exactly.
So my show, Caption This, came out of that. The title came out of Caption This. So all these actors, I've had everybody from stage, theater, film, Academy Award winner, Tony Award winner, and an Emmy Award winner in the deaf community.
Fantastic.
That you never hear about. You don't hear in legends. So this community, this linguistic community, has all of those in the performing arts.
And that aired on a cable channel out
on my
west.
Show, Caption This. It aired nationally.
Nationally. And
through Silent Network.
There's a revival coming?
And so with the...
Is this the first time it's being announced, Joanne Dean?
Yes, it is. Okay. Right here on St. Patrick's
listeners.
Day. So
rare
watch
treat.
Out for a relaunch of Caption This. And... my goal is to bring it to primetime television and cable and other platforms.
Fantastic. Any interested distributors?
Can't say just yet.
Okay,
but yes,
you're working on it.
They're out there working on it.
Knocking on wood there.
Knocking on wood, yes.
So talk about the actual movie portion, because that's going to segue into our next brilliant guest and trailblazer, Michelle Spitz, how when people go to the movies, we all take for granted the movie experience in terms of having a disability. But for people who are deaf, it's a whole nother world.
Exactly. So now going from Caption This, so that aired for a bit, and my focus ended up, captioning came about, so caption was assimilated by hearing culture. It was everywhere. So through Women in Film Los Angeles, I would go out to Sundance Film Festival annually, and... I would happen to meet deaf talent, either a writer, producer, director, or an actor. An actor that would be in an independent film that would get – so I'll talk this way first from the talent perspective. So talent that gets into an independent film, when they go to a film festival, that same talent has no representation. There's no accessibility at this for some. It still happens where the deaf actor has to look for his own interpreter. It's either not provided by a film festival, and which I have to say, where I just attended, I have to applaud Real Abilities Film Festival in New York City. 40 theaters, open caption.
Wow, each one of them. Fantastic.
So they caption all of their film. They provided, they vowed this year and going forward, all of their films will be sign language interpreted for the panel. So back then, when it segued into film and film festivals,
it was an exercise of futility. Yeah, they just went there and showed up.
They would show up and it said, "Great, you know, do you have your interpreter?"
Hmm.
So Sundance, I have to say, they did create a volunteer position. And everything is volunteer, you know, to run that festival. It's an amazing festival. So applaud them there. But they did create positions to accommodate. But it's here, it's once in a while, and you
sure.
have to ask for it. So I feel that after seeing that, then that became my passion to say, okay, I'm going to start asking filmmakers, would you like your film captioned? Would you like your film audio described? I worked with a blind.
Broader
also.
Audience. Ding, ding,
broader
ding.
Audience.
Sure, opening the doors.
And also, if you caption, if you audio describe, new audiences, new voices come about.
Absolutely. And that's a perfect segue to our next guest, Michelle Spitz. She's a VO artist. When do you hear this voice, boy? Philanthropist and also a trailblazer in the movie world, the arts world. She loves the culture, the arts movement. She loves movies, and you're going to love her voice. Take a listen to this first before we meet her live.
The moon is obscured by clouds and the tops of trees. Aaron stands in a corral in front of a horse stall. Yellow light warms the wraparound porch of a large two-story house. A woman glances at Lutz. She places her pass in the hand of the child next to her. She kneels and kisses her. Lutz takes the girl's hand. The woman's chin quivers. Her eyes fill. Fingers trace a raised line map with Braille from the top to the bottom.
My destination, Portugal.
A young woman lies on a bed on her stomach. Her brown hair is pulled in a ponytail. The balloon floats past another sign that points to the right. It says armadillo. The mouse pulls the banana. The giraffe steps on the string. The mouse tugs. Nighttime. A train with swastikas rolls past. Shiny black boots descend from the train. Words appear. SS Colonel Otto Skorzeny. He has a scar from his left ear to the corner of his mouth and chin. South Dakota. The two stare at the horizon under a gray sky.
So visual. That's the voice of Michelle Spitz, and this is also the live voice of Michelle Spitz. Welcome to the show. I'm so excited to have you, lovely
Thank
Michelle
you.
Spitz.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here.
What an incredible art form.
Thank you. Yeah. I love it.
So I want to explain to our audience that those words would only be heard if you're in a theater wearing headsets, technologically device. Make sure that the theater would have to have the technology. So these are things that we all take for granted because we can see the screen. So these are all things that you're basically given the visual. It's almost like the script for people who just can't see what's happening on a screen. And I think it's great that you, both of you, Joanne Dean and Michelle, are just trailblazers in making more and more films accessible. And, of course, the creation of Women of Her World. Word, I should say. It's kind of the same
That's
thing.
That's okay with me.
Yeah, because, you know, the world is benefiting, right? So, I mean, how did you get involved in this? Because you've been a video artist, obviously, and doing great movie features and trailers, et cetera, for many, many years. But how did this become part of your life?
This was an interesting transition. And Joanne and I met during this process after I had already slightly got into it. A gentleman who was with Universal Studios for 25 years, he was a film distributor, decided to leave the industry and go on his own, and he wanted to make films accessible for both the deaf and the blind. And I met him through somebody else, and he had asked me, would you be willing to go in the studio and do an audio description recording? And I said, I'm terribly sorry, I don't know what that is. And he said, just go in the studio and do it. And I thought, oh my God, I have no idea. So I went in, I had no practice, I had nothing other than a script, and it was for a short film. A young man, 16 years of age, did a wonderful film, a disability-based film, and I went in, I started this process. The engineer is blind, the proprietor of the station is also blind.
Love it.
And I had this very unusual experience of which I, at the end, I thought, this is really quite remarkable, and this one short film turned into nearly 35 3 years later.
Wow.
And I have committed myself to this. There's one particular film that really turned the corner for me called Driving Blind, which is a wonderful film about two brothers. It's a documentary. They both have the same eye disease, and potentially they may or may not lose their sight, and they decide to take a road trip around the United States prior to perhaps losing their vision. One now has lost his vision. One now has not, but vision has been diminished. And they needed this film for a accessibility panel, I believe, and they wanted to talk about it, and they needed audio described, and they didn't have the wherewithal to do it. So it came to my attention, would you be interested in sponsoring this? Would you be interested in voicing it? And I thought, this is a full-length film. This isn't 15 minutes. This is a long film.
Well, it's a boatload of work.
It's a boatload of work. It takes a long time. It takes about 5 hours to
average feature film.
About. Some people do it differently, but the majority of people are playing the film during this recording process. I call it my dance partner. I'm responding to what's going on in the film, the dialogue, and I'm responding in a way I want the recipients to hear my contribution in alignment with what it needs to be. So nonetheless, I've always said I walked out of that film and I thought, I'm exhausted from this experience. But I had the most euphoric feeling when I walked out of the studio. It was as if the universe had taken this juicy, fabulous red bow, tied it really tight around me and said, this is exactly why you're on the planet. This is what you're supposed to be doing. I've never experienced anything so remarkable. And I can't stop doing it. I won't stop doing it. And just to know that the sort of the recipients of this work and the gratitude that they have for what I do and the gratitude I have for the opportunity to do it is the perfect life for me. It's perfect.
It's so very fascinating if you think about this, because for sighted people, you're watching and listening. You're listening to the nonverbal cues and communication that's taking place. You're looking at all the visual things that are taking place, and you're listening to the music, the sound effects, the background, the following, et cetera. But now for a person who's blind or suffering from vision loss who can't see the screen clearly enough, you are actually, I would say, safely and confidently say, even more important, because they're relying on not only your words, which I also want to get to the writing of that, because that's got to be a whole nother specialty, but your interpretation, your inflection is so much more important than I think the actual characters, the actors and actresses, because they're solely relying on you to take them where you want them, the film should be taking and delivering them to, message or whether it's just transcending wherever they are.
That's very true. And it's a controversial sort of perspective on that in terms of how the scripts are written, for example, who writes them. And, of course, many people are educated. I don't write scripts, but I certainly have an opinion about them. And when the,
what is your opinion about them?
Well, I, as an artist and a voiceover artist, I don't think people are writing necessarily and reading back to themselves out loud to see what this is going to translate like. They're very ingrained in time codes because it's a time code.
Yes.
They want to be sure they've transitioned you from one space to another, now, then, later. This is tricky to write these scripts. As a voiceover artist, I don't want to sound redundant. I also don't want to overshadow the characters. I want to complement the content. And I want what I say to sort of lie gently on the ears of those that are listening. So there's variations of what of different people that do this work. Mm. Some are more animated. They're adding different inflection to it. Some are more flatlined. Some have various tones. Mm. I tend to try to be somewhere right in the middle of that.
Well, doesn't the scene dictate that?
It does, but it's a personal positioning that people take. I really believe, and as a voiceover artist or an actor, they're going to bring to it what they would like to bring to it. But there are sort of protocols in which we really are not supposed to be overshadowing or overpowering the actors or actresses in the content.
That makes sense.
Yeah. And I think, again, I think it's very personal. You do what feels right. I know what feels right for me, and I listen back. And for example, Do You Dream in Color? I did that film, the one that you were on the panel the other night. And
great
that,
film.
It's a wonderful film. And that film came to me through three different people. I thought the first time, well, I'm not so sure. The second time, well, okay. And a lot of what I do is I sponsor and I fund for independent films this asset. And then I donate my voice. So the value of the production financially is one cost. The other is my in-kind donation of donating my voice. So films come to me. I look for them.
It's a substantial savings.
It's a substantial. And I'm very careful what I choose to work on. But I feel extremely confident about doing films about disability, particularly films about blind subject matters, in addition to any disability, that we make that film accessible to all disabilities. And so I focus a lot of my attention around those, but I'm fascinated by lots of different things because we don't have to be exclusive to that. So the films that I am compensated for are not films that I'm choosing. They're films that I've been asked to do, or something, The Great Muppet Caper, or Miss You Already, things that are in the theaters. Mm-hmm. But primarily I want to see independent films supported, and I'd like to educate filmmakers mm-hmm. to bring this asset to their work and think about it in their post-production process when it's not such an expensive asset and it's too late in the game to add it on.
How much of the production world is aware of what you're doing and or the lack of accessibility? Mm-hmm. Joanne?
I really think it's, as Michelle said, it's a new area to educate. People have good intentions, and what I'm noticing is people say, sure, I'd love to have a caption. Sure, I'd love to have it accessible. I'd love to have film my theater and share my movie. They're artists. They want people to enjoy their work. And independent, sometimes they know that they're not going to make it. Maybe they're not going to get to the commercial, but it's a passion play. So that being said, I said, well, did you budget for it? And they said, oh, well, we just want to get the film made. Then it's considered post. So the thinking needs to change, and it's more costly. So the thinking that Michelle and I are bringing out to filmmakers, to film schools, is to say, do it all together. And I'm a grant writer, so if you put a line in the budget, if you're raising money for the film, it just trickles down.
You guys have such a great relationship.
Oh,
because your expertises are so well aligned. What one person does, the other person can augment and take to another level.
True.
Quickly, I think it would behoove, obviously, the great five Hollywood movie companies to also embrace this because, you know, 55 million disabled people in the country, and that says a lot. So, I mean, obviously, we don't know the numbers on the deaf and hearing impaired, but obviously, you know, they want to sell tickets. So
yes.
If there's another way to get people with disabilities into the theater, why not? Because how much would a device cost for them to provide a theater, do you know?
The cost is changing because the technology is also changing, and that was another issue as far as captioning. So theaters do have closed-captioned devices. So when they say that they have closed caption, they have devices. But say like when I was an educator or if I have a family of five, there might be four units. Usually it's 7 units per theater for accessibility.
And can
sometimes
you describe
more
that unit?
As far as we describe. Now what I'm speaking about is the caption unit. And so there's either caption glasses or they're glasses that are worn and then a captioning comes up. On and it's synced with the film, and it would come up. Or there's it's called a cup holder.
So that's for people who have some sight.
This is sight. This is for deaf and hard of hearing.
Okay,
so for captioning,
correct.
To be seeing the captioning. So if you have more people attending than the number of units, then you're missing a show.
And you started to mention before I cut you off there, there's another device you said that you hold?
Well, there's another device also for the audio description. You know, you would have headsets, which is a different number. You know, there's actually usually more headsets, I believe, available.
Well, how do people know if their local theater has any of these devices?
It's marked. You'll see an assistive listening device. Theaters will have it marked at the window. That's been in place. So really what's happening, one, for independent filmmakers is to put it in the budget and also, you know, budget and it will happen. You know, you want your film made. And also there's laws that are coming down for theaters where films are going to need to be accessible for both the deaf and the blind.
So I have a lot to add to this, actually. First, I want to comment on the initial sort of response of, yes, it's great for sort of production and financial means and so on and so forth. But the other thing to keep in mind is when I'm doing an audio description track and I'm donating it to the filmmaker, somehow, if it doesn't get, as an independent film, may not get to the main theaters. My request
quite
is,
often.
Yeah, my request is that it is made available on iTunes or it's made available streaming. They can put it on a DVD if they choose to do it for Amazon or just a DVD for educational purposes. I just want to know that this film is accessible. And that it reaches the audiences that
available.
Need it most. If it goes to the next level, which many do, in fact, I record for Deluxe and I've recorded for AudioEyes for main films, feature films, they are required, a lot of these companies, to do audio description. So many of them are already available. And they're provided to libraries, and then libraries can then provide them to other people. But where we're going with technology is this. We won't need headsets in the very near future here. In fact, in Europe, a lot of the smartphones are being synced into the audio description.
Oh, I love it.
And I really love it. So all the theaters are advertising audio description. It's a given. Most of Europe, a good portion of Europe, is really integrated into this. United States is integrated, but in a different way. So we need to catch up in that way.
I see a trip for the three of us in the
oh,
near
yes,
future.
I do.
What do you think, LaGuardia or JFK?
Yeah. No, it's really incredible. So we're moving in a direction where, by mandate, television program as well. There's a lot of television programming that is audio described. Captioning was in place for a long time. Audio description is slowly coming into place. Also in Spanish, there's a lot of now audio description being actually required in Spanish. So that's a whole other thing that's going on. But for example, Netflix now, the majority of their content will be audio described. And that's a whole nother sort of responsibility, which is going to trickle down. It's going to be a domino effect. It's happening across the board. A lot of people don't know that. They do, some don't. But they will be happy to know that there'll be a lot more of it than there was before.
And I'd like to add on the accessibility side, also what I see happening is, again, now you'll have a film maybe, again, for the deaf actors, for the deaf talent present, and for deaf audiences, there should be sign language interpreter provided for panels. This I see happening just for the arts, because people need access to the arts, and if you're attending a film and it's captioned, and then, and this is the talent. This is happening to deaf actors that are in films. When they go to a festival, they still have to find sign language interpreters for the panels to be able to access. And now, again, back to real abilities, you saw that they provided the interpretation or CART services, but somehow of real-time captioning. CART is a real-time captioning. There's almost like stenography.
Yes, as a matter of fact, sometimes when I speak in front of a lot of audiences, whether it's a college or a high school or a corporation, and I love to see the interpreter on stage, and sometimes I'll talk so fast to see if they can keep up.
And then I bet you would.
I roll it into a joke, and it kind of goes from there. But that's the voice of Joanne Dean. She's one of my guests this morning, accompanied by Michelle Spitz. Both of these women are pivotal in the world of making the arts more accessible for the deaf and hard of hearing. My name is Mark Farrell. The name is Insight of the Show on the Progressive Radio Network, and we got a few minutes more left in the day before we go out and get our kilts on. Do you have kilts today?
I got my shamrocks on.
Okay. I'm kiltless, but we're going to get our green on somewhere, somehow. But I want to ask you, in terms of what feedback have you gotten from moviegoers who are benefiting from this? Because I would imagine if they've never experienced something like this, their world must be rocked.
Okay, we get excited.
Here. Eeny, meeny, miny, moe. Joanne first.
Okay, quickly. Well, on an industry level, this was really exciting. I started a joint venture with Kat Kramer, Stanley Kramer, the film director, producer, with Kat Kramer. She happened to have access to Paul White, the writer, director, producer, New Yorker's Mozart in the Jungle, we're talking. Well, Paul White made the fabulous film with Lily Tomlin, Grandma. So we were given the opportunity, met Paul, and I said, deaf audiences would love this. So we showed the film at its screened Sony Classic Pictures, gave us a free screening at Sony Studios, and we brought in the deaf audience, and this is deaf talent, so actors, writers, directors, producers with hearing counterparts, industry screening. Open caption, the hearing audience loved. Now, hearing and deaf are sitting side by side, captioning on a screen, subtitles, if you want to call it. And the writers in the room all commented that, I love it. I got to see your brilliant work, Paul.
Absolutely.
Your words on the screen, on the page, and you got to see the dialogue. So that leads me to now, 25 years ago, captioning was new. Captioning's everywhere now.
Commonplace.
People really don't mind seeing captioned films.
No, not at all.
Real abilities.
It is beneficial,
as you
mentioned.
Everybody said today, I loved it. I could see everything. What I didn't hear, I saw. And nobody commented otherwise. So that was one thing. And then secondly, with Michelle's brilliant work with audio description, we did show the short film we worked on. And it was at a media access event for a nonprofit, My Hero. And the deaf that were in the audience with the blind filmmakers there, it was Running Blind, the other brother, their other film, short. The deaf community came up to the blind community, talent to talent, saying, we are the same. This was another layer because they never had access
to
the audio description. So because they're deaf, they wouldn't be wearing the headsets. Mm-hmm. We were interpreting. So I was interpreting Michelle's audio description.
Love it.
And you could see tears well up. So,
I just
Michelle.
I know we're going to end really soon here, so I just want to say a couple quick things.
Please do, Michelle.
The the responses I've received, I did opening and closing night for Real Abilities. This is my second year doing Real Abilities. I do Superfest in San Francisco where we use open description, no headsets. We have an inclusive experience. It's a really cool thing to go through. The responses I get from the people in the audience, the people that are working at Lighthouse, that are involved in this community, is so heartwarming to me, that love my work and that I've made such a difference in how I do what I do. And not only that, I'm really lucky because I get to meet a lot of the people that are in the films when they come for the film festivals, that are disabled or were involved in making the film, and I've spent all this time around their characters or their writing, and when I meet them, it is the most heartwarming, incredible experience.
Absolutely.
On the planet.
Anytime you impact someone's life like this, and think about this, ladies, the boomers.
Yeah.
You know, this is a whole untapped generation that is going to be becoming more disabled. We all are. We all break down over years in some capacity. With all the drugs and alcohol I consumed, I'm a little bit 20 years advanced for myself. Not in a good way. So I won't
Happy
be getting my
pets.
Green on too much. But anyway, so this is a whole nother reason for, you know, the big movie production companies to incorporate this. And also, obviously, for the independent filmmakers to really incorporate this. And if you have a college, for any of our listeners who have a movie production facility program, et cetera, you can feel free to reach out to me and I'll give you contact information. I can pass it on to Joanne and to Michelle because it's important for them to realize that this is an important part of their budget line, just as the catering trucks are. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, it's part and parcel, because you want to create films for entertainment, mm-hmm. for audiences, and you're limiting yourself if you do not include this audience. Any final thoughts, ladies?
You have an opening day box office draw.
Yeah.
Nationally. With
absolutely.
The digital screens.
What percentage of movies, or is this not even on the radar yet, that are coming out have accessible variables?
A lot of them.
A lot of them.
Yeah.
A lot of them. A lot
the
of
majority
them.
Of the major films.
Major studios.
They have
oh,
to be.
That's fantastic.
They have to be.
Okay.
Yeah.
By law.
It's mandated. And a lot of them, big production studios do this.
Although, on the note is that the independents that make the SAG Awards, independents now are mm-hmm. getting picked up by the studios. The independent films, and for the deaf talent that are SAG-AFTRA members, they're not getting captioned screeners, and they pay union dues.
Ooh, that's a whole nother topic.
So that's a whole nother topic for another day.
I need some Irish music.
Yeah.
Joanne Dean, you ready to jig? Michelle Spitz.
Yes.
Thank you so much for your time,
ladies.
Thanks for doing what you do. You're doing incredible work, making incredible ripples and waves for the people who can benefit the arts worldwide. Keep up the great work.
Thank you.
My name is Mark Farrell. This has been the Progressive Radio Network. My name is, my name is Mark Farrell. Since I've been up since 4:30. Oh, my God. I'm totally out of it today. Any questions or comments, hit me up at mark@markfarrellmotivation.com, mark@markfarrellmotivation.com. If you have any interest of speaking to and or questions for Michelle or Joanne, again, hit me up at mark@markfarrellmotivation.com. Have a great day, your green day. Be safe. Talk to you next Thursday. Enjoy.